Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hi, this is Mary Robson with Charlie Fleischman for Nature Now. Charlie is a nature observer and also our very helpful engineer. We are shuffling things a bit today. Today's show could not air our planned discussion of freshwater quality, including the recent problems of Anderson Lake. Our speaker had a conflict. So we are presenting a rerun of Kate Dwyer's interview with a national treasure who happens to live here, Robert Michael Pyle. If spring makes you think of poetry, you will look forward to this particular gathering between Kate and Robert Michael Pyle. But first, our mystery sound for today. This is an easy one if you have this creature in your world. Usually when we do observations, we think of different observations from different people coming in from various directions. Today, I just took a walk along a meadow and a wood's edge and observed where plants have enough light for flowering and some for eventually bearing fruit, as we will talk a little bit about. It's marvelous to see the world unfolding, especially after such a beautiful spring. My first observation, this is something you may have seen in your garden or in your long grass. This is spittlebugs. I'm particularly interested in insects, and I may be bringing in several insects into nature now as we go along. But if you have tall grasses or herbs showing white fluff, it's a foam. It looks exactly as the name implies, as if someone had spit on them. People have a tendency to go, yuck. But if you're curious enough to move the foam aside, you will see a tiny oval green nymph, which is the early stage of an insect it's going to turn into. This nymph really looks about a third the size of your little fingernail, and it makes the foam by piercing the plant stem and fluffing up the sap. And you would think, gosh, is that bad for plants? They generally do very little damage, and you see the foam in spring on many different plants. It may be a little early this year, like a lot of other things are, but the foaminess disappears later in June because the insect matures and leaves and stops needing to hide under foam. These are indeed peculiar.
Young hummingbirds. Perched on a fence edge, two small Anna's hummingbirds fledge this spring. Now that Anna's stays year-round, they hatch birds earlier than the Rufus, so their kin have a head start on summer growth. Salal in bloom, worked by bees. Salal flowers resemble blueberry blooms, being in the same family. Ripe berries are edible, eaten by native people. Some people now gather them for jam, often mixing them with Oregon grape berries. Salal berries are definitely sweeter than Oregon grape.
And making salal jam is definitely a project that requires attention to detail and patience. I am here to testify. Another thing I saw in the woods this weekend, and coincidentally on Rhody weekend, was rhododendron macrophyllum blooming in the woods. This is our native rhododendron. And the soft pink rhododendron is Washington's state flower, even though it grows only in limited range in western Washington and in the Cascades, nowhere else in the state. This may be one of those east-west dilemmas where there's more people on the west side. And actually what happened was the flower was voted as a state flower by garden groups in 1892. The World's Fair in Chicago asked each state to nominate a state flower and present it in Chicago for the World's Fair in 1893. Washington wasn't a state for very long in 1892 and didn't have a state flower. So voting of garden clubs was instituted, and there were more people voting in western Washington than were voting in eastern Washington. The one that lasted was the rhododendron, and the one that got dumped was sweet clover, which actually would have made a very interesting and kind of friendly state flower. So that's why we have a state flower that occurs only in a very small part of the state.
Moss. So iconic here, we walk right over it. In May, the colors and textures of mosses shine before summer dry times send them into dormancy. One of my favorites found on a log in this woods walk is Oregon-beaked moss, resembling feathers. For a guide to woods plants, including mosses, check out Plants of Coastal British Columbia by Pojar and McKinnon.
And just a comment about the Pojar and McKinnon book. It's a very good one-book guide to trees, shrubs, flowers, mosses, and lichens. It's a handy one if you want something to drop into a backpack. Finally, I don't know if this is good news. Fauna have been observed already, newly born fawns. Maybe that's where fauna comes from. Anyway, two of them, newly born, the does tend to have twins. Watch your neighborhood for more. And I have to say that the doe who lives on my drain field is definitely pregnant. We'll just have to let that be. So this brings us to the topic for today. Kate Dwyer speaking with Robert Michael Pyle. If you want to listen to the lyricism of nature, this is a wonderful interview.
We are extraordinarily pleased to bring you part two of our phone interview with Dr. Robert Michael Pyle, who was in Port Townsend last week for a presentation on butterflies of the rainforest and the rain shadow, and a poetry reading from his new book of poems, The Evolution of the Genus Iris. About this book, Henry Hughes wrote, "How wonderful to have one of our best lepidopterists and nature writers turn assuredly to poetry. Robert Michael Pyle has a scientist's precise eye, the earthy experience of a field biologist, the vast knowledge and lexicon of a scholar, and the sensibility and wisdom of a very fine poet. Welcome, Bob. I'm not shy to admit that you are one of my heroes, and I'd like to start by asking how you are able to be three men in one, a fine writer, avid conservationist, and a leading lepidopterist. What a balancing act."
Thank you, Kate, and hello, and thank
hello.
You so much for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
A lovely question. Let me refer to the great Montana writer David James Duncan, mm-hmm. who wrote a beautiful book called My Life as Told by Water. And I visited him once, and several times, but on one visit, I asked him how he managed to be four people in one, the nonfiction activist and the wonderful fiction writer and so on and so forth. He admitted to wearing two hats, but he claimed that I wore the same three that you've given me.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote quite delightfully that we woke up the next morning, two half-snockered nature dweebs having been suitably subtracted on red wine with five hangovers between us for the one for each hat we wore.
That's fabulous.
That was a pretty good line.
Well, great.
It's life is rich, and there's no reason to go around with one hand tied behind our backs or one or two arrows in our quiver. I've always enjoyed how words and the land fit together and in our imaginations and our minds. And I've written essay primarily for a long time. And some of that essay's been in service of conservation, and some of it's been in service of literature, and some of it's been in service of adventure, going out on big road trips with butterflies and so forth. And then, of course, trying to bring butterflies into people's lives. But I've also written fiction because that's the most fun of all, to create worlds and make things happen, see if it works. The poetry does something different from either of the above. Poetry has all of the opportunity to shuck and jive and dance around that fiction has. It has all the attention to the actual physical, as Nabokov said, the individuating details of the actual world that nonfiction has. And yet it also has its extreme concision. And concision is a beautiful thing. It's a gem-like, lapidary thing. And poetry gets to the bone. And it's fun. And people look at a short poem and they say, well, that must be a relief after those 4,000-word essays or that 500-page book. And I say, which one do you think took more time?
Exactly.
To write a good poem?
Right.
At least as much work.
Right. Well,
I wear all those hats because I believe that we are lucky denizens of a rich and diverse world, and we have not only an obligation but an opportunity to express ourselves in as many ways as we can. I feel a total obligation to be an activist all my life, have been, and all my life I want to be. So one does that. I'm lucky to have a training in science, and I do a little bit of science with butterflies. But Nabokov also said, is there not a high ridge where the mountainside of scientific knowledge meets the opposite slope of artistic imagination? And I'd like to try to aspire to walk that ridge.
Right.
And when, that's
but
why
when
I
did you
wear these different hats?
Did you discover your writing talent after you were already quite involved in science, or was that simultaneous? How did that work out?
Well, I came first with the Iowa basic tests in school way back in the 1950s and 60s. You know, you learn pretty early on whether you're any good with numbers or with words. And I was better with words, and my friend was better with numbers. So we would trade busy work so we could spend more time chasing butterflies or later on chasing girls, whatever. And I found that I could write essay contests in high school and make money at it.
Oh, that I could put away for college,
you know, Americanism essays and citizenship essays. Nothing that I ever felt engaged with particularly, but I knew what they wanted. I could get easy B's because I could write more easily, and if I worked a little, maybe an A. So one knew that one had a little more facility verbally pretty early on, but it wasn't until the summer I graduated in 1985 and had a truly overpowering experience out of doors that I ever wrote anything that I really wanted to write, an actual essay, a real essay.
What was that
not
called?
The kind we were assigned in school. Pardon?
What was that called? Do you remember that essay?
Well, it doesn't really have a name. Funny enough, I've got a 50-year selected prose volume coming out from Oregon State next year.
Oh, really?
And I begin with that piece.
Wow.
It's never been published.
I'll look forward to it.
But I went back to it and I found it. My mother and I were caught in a... Well, we weren't caught in the landslide, but we were caught up in a little mountain town called Silver Plume, Colorado, by a landslide. And it was there in a rainstorm out behind this lodge in the Colorado Rockies where I had this epiphanic experience, and it was just, everything felt really good. So I came back and wrote about it on the motel stationery. So I guess it's going to be called something like Reflections at the Millsite Inn in Silver Plume, Colorado. I don't know. But I went back and read it, of course, see if we wanted to put it in this book, and it turns out that I've been trying to write the same essay ever since. Science came after that, and then later, the putting the science and the writing together, and ultimately I realized I was more of a poet than a scientist, and the creative writing took the fore.
Yes, I'm sure that wasn't an easy decision because you had to choose between being a full-time nonprofit conservationist or an academic or a writer.
Well, now that's
right?
A whole different thing. It wasn't at all a difficult decision to decide not to be a full-time professional investigative scientist because I wasn't very good at it.
Oh.
I could do it, and I still do some with butterflies, but that was not my forte by any means, doing actual field research with numbers. Remember, I didn't have a lot of facility with numbers.
Right.
But it was much harder to decide not to, as you say, be a full-time conservationist. I worked for the Nature Conservancy. I worked for IUCN and World Wildlife Fund. I could have had pursued a career in either or a full-time academic career. And in 1982, after a house fire and a few other ructions in life, I decided to go up the middle, as Jim Owens used to say, at the University of Washington, and do neither one and write instead. So
thank goodness. That's good for us. You're one of my favorite writers.
Well, it's been good for me. Thanks to readers.
How about you share one of your poems with us from your new book?
Well, thank you for asking. You know, there are two species of giant earthworms in the Northwest, both very rare and both have been not seen for many, many years. So when one was found over in the Palouse again, there was a story about it in USA Today, the newspaper. And the title of the poem is the title of the headline from that story.
Okay.
And that is, Rare Worm Doesn't Spit or Smell Sweet. Rare Worm Doesn't Spit or Smell Sweet. Thus spake USA Today when the Palouse giant earthworm turned up again after 20 years of absence. Well, not really absence. They were down there all along, relaxing into their flaccid longitude, deep underground. Their cousins, the Oregon giant earthworms, had been missing even longer. Old lore said the Palouse giant earthworm smells like lilies. Old lore said it spits and stretches up to 6 feet long. Not so, said USA Today. These were only footlongs. No spit, no sweet scent. Kind of like finding Bigfoot. And he's only 5'10", with 9B trotters. I don't know about the spitting, but what if you were lost for 20 years, then found, and weren't the same as everyone expected? What if they all found out you don't smell like lilies? after all.
That's wonderful. Very comical. Well, thank you.
The thing is that poetry can be a whole lot of fun. And
yeah.
I think not all poets seem to convey that, but mm-hmm. poetry read carefully is full of deep wit, good sense, and love of life and the land. So that's why I write poems.
That's wonderful. Well, on to another subject. Whenever I describe this radio program, Nature Now, I say our mission is to increase nature literacy in order to increase appreciation of and connection with nature. And, of course, we hope that leads to protection, wanting to protect that which you love.
Right on.
You say this so much more eloquently in your essay, The Extinction of Experience, as well as your current essay in Orion called Free Range Kids. And let me quote from that to get you going here.
Sure.
Not from Orion, but from your essay about experience. I believe that one of the greatest causes of the ecological crisis is the state of personal alienation from nature in which many people live. We lack a widespread sense of intimacy with the living world. The extinction of experience is not just about losing the personal benefits of the natural high. It also implies a cycle of disaffection that can have disastrous consequences. Take it away, Bob. Tell us more. Go on a riff
well,
about
you.
That.
I mean, we're thinking right along the same lines, and I don't mm-hmm. think the way I say it is any more eloquent than you do on your wonderful program week after week after week, but you're absolutely right. Nature illiteracy at whatever level is profoundly troublesome, and we are disastrously illiterate toward our neighbors in the world, all of us, even those who call ourselves naturalists. People think that Fred Sharp and I and people like us know a lot about nature. Fred and I say, ha, we're just starting, you know, we aspire to learn something about nature. And it's not about knowing everything, nobody's going to. It's a matter of knowing a new neighbor a week or a year, you know, paying attention is what it's about. So when I was a kid, I had this old ditch, the Highline Canal in Colorado, that I would wander on. That's where I made my acquaintance with the world in depth. That's the subject of my book, The Thunder Tree, and that's where the extinction of experience came in, because I witnessed my first extinctions, local extinctions, along that canal as Denver and its environs grew beyond all bounds of natural limits because of the transshipment of water in Colorado. And so later on, Richard Louv, of course, wrote his stunning book, Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. And I don't think a more profound thing has been said in a very, very long time. Richard's always been, by the way, very generous in crediting the Thunder Tree as one of his inspirations for that, which is very sweet. But he's the person who brought it to so many people's attention. And so now we see programs all over the country starting up called No Child Left Inside, mm-hmm. which is surely the right way to be going. But what I really worry about, and this is what my piece in the current Orion is about, Free Range Kids, is that we, and when I say we, I mean most of us over 30, grew up, both men and women, with a degree of free range wandering in our childhoods. Even people in the city, we were able to go out and explore unsupervised. And no amount of environmental education or nature interpretation is going to duplicate that experience of the personal connection a child makes with the landscape and with the human community and the neighbors, human and otherwise. So when I call it the freedom of the day, and when the freedom of the day is lost, as it largely is in the culture now, then what profound consequences await us? And remember, Kate, this was not a gendered thing. Both boys and girls, at a time not so very distant, in most places in this country, had some freedom to wander and freely associate with other kids and with the landscapes and to do things and to explore and to have fun and do a little clabber and damage out there.
Right.
This is how they made their connection.
Yeah, in your essay you also mentioned these laws that I was appalled by, where in some states it's illegal to leave your child without an adult if they're under 12. That's against the law, or you're required to meet the school bus. They're not allowed to walk home.
Yes, right here in my own valley.
It's paranoia.
Which is least threatening place you could ever imagine for a kid to roam right in. The kids are great because they, okay, so the car meets the school bus, they go back home and they go out again, some of them, if they can break their electronic umbilicus and put their device down for 10 minutes to do it.
Right.
But it's absolutely true. This is legislated suicide culturally, I think, to legislate children away from free exploration and contact with the land.
Uh-huh.
We have to maintain that.
Reading your books, I like to think that I'm a semi-aware person of nature, even though I can't name all the birds and so on. But when I read your books and your keen awareness, it's an inspiration to me to be more alive, to be more alert. And that has got to be a good thing no matter how you look at it. Just be in there.
It absolutely is, and I'm so glad you say that, and thank you so much. You are a deeply aware person. I know that for a fact. One asks, why does one write? One reason is that it's a flawed world, and I'm speaking in terms of a socially flawed world, a mm-hmm. flawed world in the circumstances that we create for ourselves. And one thing that an artist can do is to make a day or life or an hour better, even for a little while, by engaging the listener, the watcher, mm-hmm. the observer of a great painting, whatever. So that's one reason one writes, but another one is exactly that, to try not to... I used to write a lot of environmental rhetoric, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I do some still. That has an important place, but I think it's at least as important as the great American nature writer Edwin Wade Teal did for generations in his American Seasons books, to draw people out, never mind how many things they know by name, but the fact that they are open and aware to the wider world around them. That's the great gift that the literature of the land can bring.
Thank you. That's a great place to end on, and you certainly do that. To our listeners, Bob Pyle is a fabulous nature writer. Maybe no one would be niched as nature writer. He's a fabulous writer, period. Please check out his books. Thanks, Bob, for joining us. And,
oh, thank
and
you,
I
Kate. That was a
love
sweet
meeting
interview,
you
and I appreciate
here.
It so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kate and Robert Michael. That's wonderful radio. The sound of the day is the pileated woodpecker. This is very easy to recognize if you have been around this bird or if you are a fan of the cartoon Woody Woodpecker, whose laugh is said to resemble the sounds of a pileated and whose red crest was inspired by the real bird. So this may be one of our few native birds that actually has a cartoon sponsoring it in a way. The pileated woodpecker, once you have seen it, is never forgotten. Pileated is the largest woodpecker now that the ivory-billed has been declared extinct. It has red crests, white stripes down its head, a black body, and this reminds me of colors seen in the recent wearable art show where there was so much flamboyance. The head shape looks a little bit prehistoric. This may help it in banging tree trunks for insects. The brain of woodpeckers does have a bit of a cushion in it, which keeps them from essentially hurting themselves when they're wanging away at trees. They make a distinctive rectangular hole. So if you are looking at a standing stump and you see a hole that is rectangular, that's the hole made by the pileated woodpeckers. These are great birds. I was once on a tour bus in Maine, which stopped right in the middle of the road. Fortunately, nothing else was there because the driver had spotted a pileated woodpecker and he wanted us all to get out and look at it. If you have one of these in your neighborhood, consider yourself blessed because they require mature conifers for their insect hunting. Upcoming events. Things are a little quiet after Roadie Weekend. I finally realized that everyone in town is either in the parade or standing next to it, enjoying it. Two events. Both of these are from the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society. The first is that on May 20th at 7 p.m., the membership meeting of the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society will be held. That's from 7 to 9. And for more information, check their website. The next one, from also the Audubon Society, runs from Wednesday, May 27th to Friday, May 29th. It is a trip to eastern Washington to observe birds that often can't be seen on this side of the Cascades. Again, check with OPAS for more information about this. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the third week in May. Be sure to listen next week to celebrate Kate Dwyer. She had the inspiration to create Nature Now over 200 shows ago. The success and effectiveness of this show comes from her constant attention over 3 years. Thank you, Kate. Kate will present her last regularly scheduled show, and she'll be underwater with USGS fisheries biologist Nancy Elder, who does scuba diving surveys of the marine world. She is working at the mouth of the Elwha River, looking into the changes that have occurred since the dams went in. Thanks very much for joining me and Charlie Fleischman, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, at 11:30 on Saturday, and will be available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Production coordinator is Mike Schlexer. Today's closing music is Cool Water, performed by Marty Robbins.
And with the dawn I'll wake and yawn and carry on to water. Cool, clear water. Keep a moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man, and he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me? Water, cool, clear water. The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we pray for water.